Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Diagnostic Markers for Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Michael Levy and Dr. Carlos Pardo. Dr. Michael Levy is an associate professor of neurology and the medical director of general neurology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Levy specializes in taking care of patients with neuroimmunologic diseases, including multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, and neuromyelitis optica. In the laboratory, Dr. Levy's research focus is on the development of neural stems for regenerative therapy in these diseases. He uses rat and mouse models to test the survival, differentiation, and functional capacity of human neural stem cells to improve neurologic function in post-inflammatory conditions. The goal of his laboratory and clinical effort is to translate the basic science stem cell work to a human trial in transverse myelitis and other neuroimmunologic diseases. Dr. Pardo is an associate professor of neurology in the Division of Neuroimmunology and Neuroinfectious Disorders and Pathology in Neuropathology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. He's the principal investigator of the Neuroimmunopathology Laboratory, member of the HIV Neurosciences Research Group, and clinical neurologist at the Multiple Sclerosis and Transverse Myelitis Centers at Johns Hopkins Hospital. His clinical specialization is on neuroimmunological and infectious disorders of the central nervous system, with particular focus on multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, neurosarcoidosis, and neurological complications of autoimmune disorders. Welcome, and thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Gigi, for having us here.
Thank you. So to start, just to give everyone listening a little bit of context, can we just talk a little bit about what a biomarker is?
Biomarker is a word that we use frequently to define a marker or some parameter that may help us to establish either diagnosis or to establish parameter of a disease mechanism or disease progression. And is a term that we have been using widely in the past 10 years. Understanding what a biomarker is very important for this podcast, because what we like to inform our patients is a biomarker is a tool that we frequently use to help and support the diagnosis of transverse myelitis, or spinal cord disorder. And there are different types of biomarkers. There is a biomarker that help us to diagnose a disease. So those are diagnostic biomarkers. And a very good example of that are the antibody tests that we frequently request when we like to diagnose autoimmune disorders. And in the case of myelitis, myelopathies, and transverse myelitis, one of the best known one is the neuromyelitis optica antibody, or anti-aquaporin 4, that is an antibody in blood or in spinal fluid that help us to diagnose neuromyelitis optica. So that is what we understand a biomarker of diagnosis, or diagnostic biomarker. There are other biomarkers that may help us to identify mechanism of the disease. Mechanism of the disease is the way as the body is dysregulated or something is going on in our body to help that produce damage of a tissue or organ, and eventually is going to serve as a model for what is going on in that specific organ. NMO is probably a good biomarker for a mechanism of the disease because it's an indicator that something abnormal in the immune system is going to damage the spinal cord or the brain or any other structure of the system. But in addition to those blood biomarkers, there are other biomarkers that are clinical biomarkers. The clinical assessment and the clinical interview that we do with our patients provide a lot of information about biomarkers. For example, there are biomarkers of clinical presentation that is basically how the disease is manifesting. Time, for example, is a good biomarker. So we are able to say that a patient develop a hyperacute neurological problem if that symptom of that neurological problem present in a matter of seconds or minutes. We have biomarkers of clinical progression. We have biomarkers of for defining the magnitude and extension of the disease. For example, when we request magnetic resonance imaging of the spinal cord or the brain, we precisely are looking for biomarkers of several disorders. We are looking for demyelinating plaques in the brain, and MRI help us to characterize those demyelinating plaques. So technically, that is a biomarker that help us to establish diagnosis. So that is the general view of what is the meaning of biomarker, and I'm very sure that Dr. Levy also has other ways to explain the meaning of a biomarker.
We use the term biomarker as a very broad term, as you were saying, as any test or any indicator of disease activity or diagnosis. The aquaporin for antibody is a classic one. MOG is another one. And we look for biomarkers in order to be more certain about our diagnosis rather than just using clinical criteria. But yeah, what you explained was pretty thorough.
Okay, great. Thank you. That was a really great overview to kind of shape our conversation today. You talked about some of these tests or mechanisms to diagnose these disorders, but what tests are done to diagnose these disorders and what do they look for? And can they tell us anything about the severity of an attack or someone's prognosis? Dr. Levy?
Yeah, let's start with neuromyelitis optica, since that has a blood test, a biomarker test that people have been using a lot since about 2004. It's against the aquaporin 4 water channel. And there are many ways of detecting that antibody. Quest Diagnostics and Mayo and lots of other groups have developed tests, and some are better than others. But if any of them are positive, then we call that a positive test. And for the case of aquaporin 4, we don't use the antibody in any other way except to make the diagnosis. So once you test positive, you're done. I never need to test you again. Even if you have a relapse, it's not because of the level of aquaporin 4, anything else about the antibody. So it's a once positive, always positive type of test. But there are other biomarkers for diseases, for example, in MOG antibody disease, where the level matters and the persistence matters. So we have people with optic neuritis who test positive for the MOG antibody, and the MOG antibody may go away in a year or 6 months, and we need to know that, so we check it again. And maybe the antibody levels matter. For example, we see patients in the hospital who have really, really high levels of MOG antibody during a relapse, and then it goes down after the relapse, and maybe we can predict an attack using the MOG antibody level. So there are different biomarkers for different tests. In transverse myelitis, we started looking for a genetic mutation that's associated with some familial forms of transverse myelitis. A genetic test is obviously a test of something that you're born with. You have this mutation your whole life, and then at some point in your life, you develop transverse myelitis, not because of anything in the gene necessarily, but it's a predisposition that allows you to get the transverse myelitis. So those are some of the biomarkers for MS, and we won't get into too much MS, as the transverse myelitis is the group for patients who don't have MS usually. But in MS, we have spinal fluid tests that are really good biomarkers for MS. Carlos, am I missing any biomarkers?
No, that I think that that's a very good approach to understand the concept. One thing that I like to emphasize is the blood testing is not the only source of biomarker information. The first encounter that we have with patients and when we do neurological examinations, actually we are looking for clinical biomarkers. In other words, when we test reflexes or we test the motor strength or we test the ability to walk, actually we are looking for biomarkers. We like to understand if there is any clinical expression of diseases that are associated or not with the spinal cord. The same happened with MRIs. In the MRIs, we are evaluating the presence or absence of inflammation in the spinal cord, and we look for focal areas of abnormalities in those MRIs or enhancement in those MRIs. So we are precisely looking for those biomarkers that help us to characterize disease and the particular case of myelitis or myelopathies to help us to understand what is going on in the spinal cord. So it's very important to have this understanding because in that way, we can build up a comprehensive evaluation and diagnostic approach in our patients.
Okay, thank you. And do these markers, can they tell us about the severity of an attack or someone's prognosis moving forward? Like, are you able to see that on imaging or through any of the kind of biomarkers we've talked about?
So I think one of the biomarkers we haven't talked a lot about is imaging, as you said, Gigi. And MRI is a great biomarker of injury in the spinal cord and in the optic nerve and in the brain. And it's very useful in making a diagnosis, but it's not that helpful in making these long-term predictive decisions. So I've seen patients with really bad attacks on an MRI, but they could be functioning very well. And conversely, I've seen patients who have a devastated exam, but their MRI doesn't look that bad to me. And so it's not a great biomarker of prediction, with one exception, and that is that after a long period of time of recovery, 6 or 12 months, if we see atrophy on MRI, then sometimes that's an indicator of permanent damage. And we can correlate that. So if a patient has permanent or severe weakness that's associated with that kind of atrophy, then sometimes we link the two and we say, well, maybe that's the cause. So that's the only real prediction tool that I use is the MRI. All the other biomarkers in the spinal fluid and in the blood and any other imaging tests, I don't think are that helpful in predicting these long-term outcomes.
Okay, that makes sense. And we've talked a little bit about this, you know, we talked about the aquaporin 4 antibody, but do different disorders have different diagnostic features? You know, the example that was given was, you know, people with NMO maybe having longer lesions in the spinal cord. Dr. Pardo?
So one of the important aspects of spinal cord disorders is the features that are evaluated by imaging of the spinal cord. So imaging allow us to characterize if a lesion in the spinal cord is small or is extensive. Longitudinal extensive myelopathies is a very wide spectrum of disorders of the spinal cord in which we are able to predict in some way if there is any immunological problem, any inflammatory problem, or any vascular problem. So the finding of a longitudinal extensive myelopathy in the MRI is not a definite marker for inflammation. It's not a definite marker for neuromyelitis optica because there are several other disorders that unfortunately present with longitudinal extensive myelopathies. A good example of that is, for example, the presence of venous strokes of the spinal cord or venous abnormalities of the spinal cord that are frequently associated with longitudinal extensive lesions when we evaluate the MRI. There are other disorders in the spectrum of inflammatory myelopathies that produce longitudinal extensive myelopathies. For example, sarcoidosis, that is a pulmonary disease that frequently affects lymph nodes and is frequently a problem in patients from African American descent or patients from Nordic European descent. Thus, patients with sarcoidosis occasionally present with longitudinal extensive inflammatory lesions. And in that particular situation, what we need to do is that in addition to the clinical presentation, in addition to the imaging analysis, we need to pay a lot of attention to the presence of other comorbidities like sarcoidosis, or in the case of NMO, we need to test the presence of the antibody, or if there is any concern for a vascular venous problems, we may need to go and do more imaging analysis to make sure that we are not missing the possibility that there are other pathologies that are producing these longitudinal extensive myelopathies. So in summary, yes, there are different disorders that produce similar abnormalities in MRI, but is the responsibility of a neurologist and a clinician trying to identify what is the cause of that longitudinal extensive lesion. And in that way, there is need for a more dedicated blood testing or cerebrospinal fluid testing, or even more studies with the imaging of the spinal cord.
Okay. And then, you know, so are we able to determine whether someone, so there's, you know, there's idiopathic transverse myelitis, which maybe is a one-time sort of thing. Are we able to determine through medical testing or through biomarkers whether someone is at a higher risk of having another attack in the future? Dr. Levy?
We looked at that exact question because sometimes, well, if we can predict if a patient's going to have a relapse, then we can intervene and potentially prevent the relapse. So we looked at all of the cases of transverse myelitis that came to Hopkins. And we asked the question, out of all those cases, who proceeded to relapse? And could we predict that based on characteristics like race, age, sex, something demographic, or maybe a characteristic on the MRI or blood test? And what we found is that there were some obvious answers, like the Occoquan 4 antibody that predicted a 100% chance of relapse. So that's consistent with what we know about that test. But there were some other biomarkers that were interesting. One was the length of the lesion on the MRI. The longer the lesion, the more likely it correlated with a relapse. And that presumes that the attack was inflammatory, not vascular, as Dr. Pardo was mentioning. So the length of the lesion on the MRI. The second was sex, and then the third was race. And so females who are African American were almost four times more likely to relapse than a young white male. And that, of course, again, is dependent also on the length of the lesion, but just if the lesions are the same, a female sex and African-American race are much, much higher predisposing factors for a relapse. So that's something that we can use clinically. If a patient comes in and she's African-American, and she has a long lesion, I'll say, look, even before the Occoquan 4 test comes back, there's a good likelihood that you're going to relapse, and we can potentially prevent that.
Okay. And then, Dr. Levy, you also talked a little bit about this, that when someone tests positive for Occoquan 4 antibody, you know, they're positive, that, you know, that's kind of stays the same over time. Do these markers ever change over time? So can someone be Occoquan 4 negative and then turn out to be positive at a later date?
Yes, for Occoquan 4, we retest yearly for 3 years or until a better test comes out, because we have seen lots of cases where an Occoquan 4 test is initially negative and then becomes positive. And in fact, the only thing that we know that makes it more likely to test positive the next time is a relapse. And the more relapses you have, if you truly have NMO, the more likely you are to test positive eventually with those relapses. So we do test yearly or with attacks or when tests are that come out are better. But with MOG, it's a little bit different. With MOG, you can have a positive test and then never have another attack again. And so we retest the antibody at 6 or 12 months. If you test negative, so you go from positive to negative, then there's a good chance you're not going to relapse, at least 50% chance. So we may not need to use treatment to prevent the attack. And if you stay positive for MOG, then there's a decent chance you're going to relapse. We don't exactly have that quantified yet. But if the titer goes up, then we're more concerned and we may offer treatment. So aquaporin 4 levels we don't care about. But if you're negative to start off with, then yes, we do retest.
Okay. And then, you know, are people misdiagnosed often, or what happens when people are misdiagnosed? Does it influence the treatment or their prognosis? Dr. Pardo?
So that's an interesting question and at the same time challenging question. So when we encounter a patient with a myelopathy, it is our obligation to understand the clinical presentation, what is the temporal profile of symptoms, what is the distribution of abnormalities, meaning motor deficits, meaning deficits associated with neurological disability. And with that information on hand, we need to take account of the biomarkers that we can get. So in the case of brain and spinal cord imaging, those are very powerful tools to help us to understand if we are evaluating a patient with a spinal cord, exclusive spinal cord damage, or if we are evaluating a patient with a spinal cord plus brain abnormalities, like is the case of multiple sclerosis. And in addition to the brain imaging that will provide information about localization in the spinal cord, we have access also to other tools like spinal fluid analysis that help us to determine if there are elements of inflammation in the spinal fluid that will help us to support the diagnosis of an inflammatory condition of the spinal cord. And that spinal fluid, by the way, is very helpful for us for obtaining information about presence of demyelinating diseases, because there are some biomarkers that we can test in the spinal fluid that help us to understand if the likelihood of a demyelinating disease is high. And the spinal fluid, by the way, may help us also to understand if there is any antibody present in the spinal fluid like NMO that actually will facilitate the diagnosis of NMO. So as you can see, the diagnosis of a myelitis or myelopathy is something that brings different elements, including the clinical assessment, imaging of the spinal cord with MRI and spinal fluid analysis. And on top of that, we may need to use also blood biomarkers, because frequently there are systemic diseases like autoimmune disorders that may induce spinal cord damage. So those blood biomarkers are actually very helpful. And frequently when we encounter patients for the first time, we are obligated to evaluate that situation and come with a good diagnostic plan and confirm if we are dealing with an inflammatory myelopathy or we are dealing with something different. So the process of ruling out other conditions is extremely important, particularly during the first encounter with patients with transient myelitis or myelopathies.
Okay, and to follow up with that, you mentioned kind of looking at these, maybe these bigger conditions that to really hone in on the diagnosis. Someone did ask about what biomarkers are used to diagnose neurosarcoidosis, and you know, do genetics play a role in this disease? Dr. Pardo, if you could just address that.
So for sarcoidosis and neurosarcoidosis, one of the important aspects is to understand if the disease in the spinal cord is part of a complex of systemic diseases or disorders or symptoms. Sarcoidosis is a frequent problem that involves Lungs and lymph nodes is an inflammatory condition that is primarily affecting the pulmonary system and lymph nodes. And frequently, when we need to confirm if there is a presence or absence of sarcoidosis, we need to pay attention to the lungs. And for that reason, we order images techniques like a CT scan of the lungs or other radiological tests like an X-ray to make sure that that patient has or not any evidence of pulmonary involvement. If we find evidence of abnormalities in the lungs or lymph nodes, the next step is to confirm if those changes are associated with sarcoidosis. And unfortunately, the only way to do that is performing biopsies of the lymph nodes or biopsies of the lung to obtain tissue. And in that way, we are able to confirm if the inflammatory changes that we recognize in sarcoidosis are present or absent. And if we are able to achieve that, and the patient with a myelopathy, for example, that is a longitudinal extensive myelopathy, and the patient is demonstrated to have these pulmonary abnormalities, and we prove with biopsy that those are sarcoidosis related, very likely that myelopathy is associated with neurosarcoidosis, and we will confirm the diagnosis in that way. So again, that is the value of putting all pieces together, and that implies that we need to get a lot of information, not only about the neurological situation, but also about what is going on systemically in other organs and in other components like a blood and spinal fluid.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Pardo. And then, Dr. Levy, going back, you talked a little bit about the research you did looking at predictive, you know, what might predict someone having a relapse. This is a follow-up question to that. Someone asked if what the normal time frame for a relapse was. So did you find that there was, you know, within a certain number of years or months that people, if they were going to relapse, did indeed relapse?
Yeah, we found that people who were on medicine relapsed about every 15 months if they failed the medicine. And if they were not on preventive medicine, the relapse rate was once every 7 months. And the average there is about once every 12. And so we considered three standard deviations to be protective against a relapse. So that was about 3 years. So what we said was, if you were more than 3 years out from your attack, then the chances of having a relapse are less than 5%. That is not true if you tested positive for aquaporin 4. We have enough patients who've had these long-term remissions that have eventually relapsed, that we know better, that patients with aquaporin 4 antibody have a relapse 100% of the time. But those who test negative and go beyond 3 years have a less than 5% chance. So that's what we found in our study.
Okay, thank you. And then Dr. Levy, again, we did get some questions about the genetic study that you're conducting. You know, one, if you could just talk a little bit about what it is that you found, you know, what it means if someone tests positive for this or not. And then, you know, whether anyone is looking kind of at the entire DNA of TMA patients to see if there's other similarities or if it's just looking at this one marker.
Actually, this is a great story. It's really interesting how we came upon this gene. We had two patients with transverse myelitis, these two sisters, one who we knew of since 2005, and she'd had a transverse myelitis 30 years prior, so as a teenager. But then when her sister developed the exact same presentation at age 50, so about 35 years after her sister did, they came to us and they said, is this genetic? Because look, now we have two sisters in this family. Both of them had the exact same presentation of transverse myelitis. And we have three other healthy siblings who have not had transverse myelitis. Can you study us? And we salivated at this opportunity, no pun intended, because we collected their saliva, isolated their DNA, and sent it to a sequencing center here at Hopkins. And we asked the question, what's different about those two sisters compared to the other three healthy siblings. And they found only one genetic mutation. Happened to be in a gene that we've never heard of, that we didn't think was important at all in the neurologic system. So we kind of sat on it for a while until Dr. Pardo hosted a patient day at Hopkins where we educated patients on transverse myelitis. And I asked everyone who was interested to please spit in a tube and I would do the genetic sequencing on those patients. And we found another patient with that same mutation. And the interesting thing is that there are no other human beings on this earth that have ever been sequenced that have that mutation. And even if you look at all the other animals, mammals and reptiles and every other animal that has this gene, there's no mutation at that site, except our three patients with transverse myelitis. So that was really compelling. The statistics on that are remarkably tight, that a patient who has this mutation will also have transverse myelitis. And we know that it's inherited because we have family members who have the carrier gene, so that is, they don't have the full mutation, but they only have part of it. And so we know it comes down through the family. We think the only way to get the disease is if you have the mutation on both of your genes. Every human has two copies of every gene, one from the mother, one from the father, and you have to have a mutation from both to get this condition. And so we got a very generous grant from the Transverse Myelitis Association to look at the rest of the gene, not just this mutation, but in other parts of the gene. So we're doing that now. We're sequencing the rest of the gene. And to do every other gene, there are 30,000 genes, would take a lot of resources that we just don't have at the moment. But it's something that in the future we would like to do because there must be some genetic predisposition to developing transverse myelitis. And whether it's part of this family of genes or some other gene altogether, one of the best ways to do that is to be able to sequence all of our patients and to sequence all of their genes and then to collect them and compare them to people who've never had transverse myelitis. So that's something that we're very excited about. And you should stay tuned because this summer and this fall we'll complete the study that the Transverse Myelitis Association has funded, and we'll see if there are any other mutations in this gene in particular.
Great. Thank you for that summary. I have another follow-up question. Sorry, one more about the study you talked about in terms of, you know, time to relapse. This person is positive for the AQP4 test and they're on medication and it's worked for the last 2.5 years for them. So is what you were saying that they're going to have a relapse despite the success of the med so far, or how should someone kind of interpret that information?
Yeah, I didn't actually explain it well. So if you're on medication for NMO, then and you're on, say, like rituximab, which has an 80% chance of putting you into remission, then you're not part of the statistic of a relapse every 7 months or a relapse every 15 months. If you're in remission, then we don't even have a number to use to calculate that number. So you're not part of that statistic. And so the numbers are pretty good for medications that we use for NMO to keep you in remission. If you're in remission on whatever therapy you're using for 2.5 years, chances are that is a pretty good medication for you, and you have a pretty good chance of remaining in remission as long as you take the medicine. We know from people who've stopped their medication that the disease comes back as it was before at some period of time in the future after you stop the medicine. So we don't take anybody off of medications because the disease never really turns over or goes away, at least for alcoporin 4 NMO.
All right, thank you. So Dr. Pardo, you talked a little bit about maybe these broader, autoimmune conditions that someone with transverse myelitis might also have. So one of the questions came in that this person has TM and Hashimoto's disease, and their son has celiac disease. So it appears that they have some issues with autoimmune diseases in their family. They're asking, should other members of our family be screened for markers for more rare neuroimmune disorders? And are these tests readily available worldwide? Or who and what should they ask for? Dr. Pardo.
So it's a very interesting and challenging challenging question as well. So the fact that there are autoimmune disorders in the family means that that family specifically has some susceptibility to autoimmune disorders. The major issue of testing and forecasting if there are going to be more autoimmune disorders in other members of the family is extremely, extremely difficult, particularly because in terms of susceptibility to autoimmunity and the genetics of that, there is a lot of variability. So at this moment, we don't have a test that will predict if other members of the families are going to show up with similar autoimmune disorder or other rheumatological problems. The only way to do that is probably to do a more extensive genetic susceptibility test using sequencing of the entire genome, and is something that is not practical at this moment. And even if we are able to identify genes of susceptibility, that identification of those genes will not predict if a patient is going to have or not an autoimmune disorder. So the only thing that we can do and we can instruct the family members is just to be alert to the onset of symptoms that may suggest rheumatological disorders or autoimmune disorders. And in that way, that will provide a very clue if there is an ongoing autoimmune or rheumatological disorder. So in other words, it's much better to be alert. And if there is any sign or symptom suggestive of some autoimmune disorder, that should be evaluated properly by the clinician. But at this moment, there is no room for predictive tests of autoimmune disorder. There is no biomarker that magically can tell you if other members of the family are going to be affected by those disorders.
Right, okay. And so kind of also going back to the beginning, we talked about the different tests and exams that can be done. So one of the questions, this person fell ill in 2010 and saw several doctors for months and years. This included neurologists, infectious disease specialists, MS specialists, and had several neuro exams, MRIs, a spinal tap, blood tests, nerve conduction tests, and no one definitively confirmed TM. They just found it mentioned in one of their summaries of their visit, I'm assuming. So it seems all they did was rule out things. So is there any other test that someone, you know, in this situation could have to diagnose something like transverse myelitis?
Well, there is a 2002 group that came together and decided how to rule in transverse myelitis, that what are the features clinically and radiologically and on spinal fluid that we would all accept as the diagnosis of transverse myelitis. And one of them is an MRI, the other one is spinal fluid, and like I said, clinical. And so it takes a little bit of some testing and some time to maybe people putting their heads together to try to figure out if that happened. It's harder to make a diagnosis of transverse myelitis in the past than it is to make a transverse myelitis of an active case. So it can be more difficult. Sometimes, though, doctors put transverse myelitis in a note, it ends up in a note because sometimes we're using that as a billing code to get a test done. And it doesn't always mean that that's what they're suspecting. So for that patient, what I would recommend is go back to that doctor, say, do you think I have transverse myelitis? Do you suggest I go to a transverse myelitis center for further workup? But there are some generally agreed upon criteria for making the diagnosis that can be done at a non-specialized center. And then for those unique cases, we suggest coming to Hopkins or another specialty center.
Okay, thank you. And do all of these disorders have, you know, diagnostic criteria that are available for a physician to find, or, you know, a patient who's maybe thinking that this might be something that they have to get access to, or if you could just speak a little bit about that.
So diagnostic criteria exist for a lot of disorders. Unfortunately, in the case of transverse myelitis, the diagnostic criteria that we established back in 2002 needs further revision. In other words, it's 2018. We need to go back and define and redefine some of the major aspects for establishing a diagnosis of myelitis. One thing that is very clear is in some disorders like neuromyelitis optica, or myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein-associated disorders, MOG, we have a better characterization of biomarkers that help us to establish the definite diagnosis. So, but again, I don't think that we have a very full view of criteria. And even for other disorders like neurosarcoidosis or vascular myelopathies, the only criteria that we have is the documentation of the clinical spectrum of problems plus documentation by MRI or angiogram that those disorders exist. So again, that is a work in progress, and probably in the next few years, we are going to have a better and better definition of some of these diseases. One thing that we have learned, particularly in the case of transient myelitis, is that there is an active process of clinical research and basic science research that is defining and redefining every year different aspects of the disease. And probably the best example of that is neuromyelitis optica. We learned about neuromyelitis optica back in 2004 and 2005 when the Mayo group discovered that the neuromyelitis optica was associated with an antibody that targets aquaporin 4. And every year we are discovering more and more antibodies, for example. More recently, Dr. Levy discovered these new genes for transient myelitis. So every year we are learning more and more about the biology of myelopathies and spinal cord inflammation, and it's very likely that establishing a strict criteria for diagnosis is not necessarily a very reliable approach. And rather than that, it's much better to come with a clinical approach that is supported by imaging and a laboratory test. And in that way, we will be able to establish a better diagnosis and perhaps better treatment.
Okay, thank you. And then going back to Dr. Levy, what you were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, having a neurologist test for these markers, can any neurologist order these tests, or does someone have to go to a specific TM center to get these tests?
The genetic testing is not commercially available. It's something that we're doing here at Hopkins. We also have a remote program where patients can contact me either through the TMA or directly, and we'll send a kit so that we can test you here using the sample that you send by FedEx. Other tests like aquaporin 4 and now MOG are commercially available, so you can get that done and sent by your neurologist wherever you are. And if it's positive, it's probably worth getting at least one expert visit from any center near you that has expertise in neuromyelitis optica, just to make sure you're on the right track, that you're on the right medication, and that there's nothing that's obviously that needs to be changed. But yeah, those are, and then MRIs can also be done locally. The nice thing about MRIs is you can send them now digitally to different labs or different radiologists to have some expertise weigh in if necessary.
Okay, thank you. And for some of the, you know, the blood tests, are there certain tests that are better than others at, you know, assessing if someone, for example, is aquaporin 4 positive? You know, I know that there are different kind of types of tests that that are out there.
Yeah, there are several different types of tests. And some of it may just depend on where your insurance will pay for the test. The Mayo claims to have the most sensitive one, which means that if you're definitely an NMO patient, then you're most likely to test positive on their test. But what I usually do is I have access to two testing sites, one at Quest and one at Mayo, and I usually send both. Now, only rarely will one test positive and the other test negative, but I'll notify the other lab if one is positive, one's negative, to verify that the other one is actually negative. Because we do have a few cases where one's positive, one's negative, and the patient actually has the disease. So there are, I wouldn't say one is better than the other. I would say that they're just different. And the broader you can go in terms of which labs you're testing, then the better coverage. But I would say for most people, more than 90%, any one lab test is going to, if you're positive, you're going to test positive.
Okay, got it. Thank you. And then, you know, as we're getting to the end of our time today, is there any current research that's taking place to determine what biomarkers will be useful in the diagnosis of and treatment of these disorders, or any, you know, any kind of modality that's being used? Like, for example, we've talked in our blogs and some article summaries we've done on diffusion tensor imaging, for example.
So there are a lot of images techniques that have been improving diagnosis. And one of the efforts that we have been doing with colleagues in other centers is try to see if we are able to visualize better inflammation in the spinal cord. MRI techniques are being improved. You mentioned diffusion tensor imaging. That is a very sophisticated approach to characterize different pathways in the central nervous system. One of the difficult times with imaging in the spinal cord is the spinal cord itself is a small structure. It's not greater in diameter, greater than 1.5 centimeters. And that is a limitation because the current imaging technique lack a very precise resolution. And the ones that are available at this moment are still on a research validation. So very likely in the future, we are able to obtain such tool for imaging. There is also active research in images associated with PET scanning. PET scanning is a nuclear medicine test in which ligands or proteins that have been labeled with nucleotides that are radioactive are used to image different tissues and different structures. So PET scanning of the spinal cord is improving, particularly because there are new markers that are very helpful to characterize microglial activation or monocyte macrophage activation or even T-cell inflammation. So those are very likely coming into the clinical practice in the next couple of years and are going to be very useful for evaluation of acute inflammation or early diagnosis of transient myelitis.
Great, thank you. And, you know, is there anything that we haven't really talked about that you think is important to bring up about this discussion, either Dr. Levy or Dr. Pardo?
I mean, the only thing I would add is that there is a lot of interest in this area, just in the grant funding and the interest I've seen at conferences, national conferences, to identify new biomarkers. These could be antibody blood tests, these could be MRI means, photographs of the eye, all kinds of different ways of assessing outcomes. It's something that clinical trials are dependent on, so pharmaceutical companies are investing in this, the government's investing in this. This is something that's really exciting, and also genetics as a whole new field to really understand who is predisposed to develop these diseases, why do some people recover better than others. And so we're only beginning to scratch the surface of this area, and I think it's a very exciting area of research.
I'd like to extend the gratitude to all people that participate in the podcast. And Gigi, thank you so much for organizing and inviting us to discuss about biomarkers. And again, in the future, please be supportive of the Transient Myelitis Association. We do our research with biomarkers. We do our research with the different problems affecting the spinal cord. Thank you to the support of all patients and family. And this is the best effort that we can do for making sure that our patients gets better.
Thank you. Thank you both so much. We really appreciate it. This is a great discussion. Talked about a lot of things. And then I just, for all the listeners out there, I just want to remind everyone that this has been recorded and it'll be made available on our website in our resource library. We also have a list of clinical studies and trials on our website as well, including some of Dr. Levy's studies. So if you're interested in participating in research, there's a whole list there that you can look through and see. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gigi.
Bye.